Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Charting Queer Health, a podcast at the intersection of queer culture, healthcare, and research. On behalf of Howard Brown Health here in Chicago, as always, I'm your host, Matt. I'm a cis, white, gay man, a Chicago resident, but most importantly, I have the incredible opportunity to sit down with various experts from across our organization here and across our community to learn from their expertise, amplify their stories and voices, and advance the conversation surrounding queer healthcare. Joining us today is Dr. Gregory Rauch. Gregory, thank you for coming. Would you mind introducing yourself, your preferred pronouns, and your role here at Howard Brown?
Yeah, my name is Greg Rauch. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I am the anal health physician at Howard Brown.
Anal health physician. This is a fun episode, but I'm excited to get the whole truth, pun intended. We were talking before this, and I was like, I feel like I'm going to include a lot of like inadvertent or advertent butt puns. So strap in, everyone. But
of course.
Anal health is an interesting topic because it's, I feel like, a very important part of medicine, but probably one that people don't usually gravitate towards or at least like to think about from both like the patient and provider side. So take me back to you in med school. What drew you, if anything, to anal health and how did you end up here at Howard Brown?
Sure. This was certainly not on my radar back in med school. Actually, when I was back in med school, a lot of these things weren't even taught or talked about. I left med school and did an internal medicine residency in Chicago and then started working in primary care, which I did for many years before delving into anal health, I guess you should say. So it was, as far as how I got into this, at first I was working in a private practice in the suburbs. Nobody talked about LGBT plus issues. I was there for 9 years, and then I actually ended up moving over to Rush, where I wanted to focus on LGBTQ health and kind of became the first person at Rush to actually focus on that as far as primary care. And then it was in the midst of COVID, everything else. I used to refer a lot of people to one of the physicians who specializes this in Chicago, and he recruited me to come to his practice. And at first I was like, I don't want to do that. That's why I refer it out. But eventually, you know, with everything going on in medicine, I said, you know what, let's give this a shot. And kind of went from there.
Yeah. So it feels like you just noticed the need for LGBTQ health in general. And then it was like, well, anal health is a big part of that. Let me just take this on. And now it's your go-to thing. So
exactly.
That makes sense. So anal health, I was about to ask like what is included in anal health, but like maybe a better way to go about it is like, what is a normal day like for you in terms of what kind of patients you see, what kind of, you know, procedures or symptoms you're on the lookout for? Like what is anal health to you?
Yeah, sure. So anal health isn't an actual specialty of medicine that's defined. Being Howard Brown, it's one of the departments that we have because we have the population that really needs the services. Mm-hmm. As far as people who do what I do, it's a mix of primary care physicians, colorectal surgeons, infectious diseases doctors, all different kind of providers from all different specialties have kind of fallen into this and do it in different capacities in different places. But again, we're Howard Brown, so we have a much higher population, much more of a need for this.
Gotcha. Okay. So yeah, this is the fun part about me hosting this podcast because I have next to no medical experience. So it's not a specialty in the way that like you don't go to be a surgeon or, you know, a dermatologist or anything. Anal health is not one of those categories, but it's a area of focus for
exactly.
somebody.
Exactly. I mean, okay. My background is internal medicine. Gotcha. Again, I did primary care for years and then slipped into this.
Internal medicine always confused me as a title because like, technically, isn't all medicine like internal to the body? Sure. Like I just never knew how to categorize that.
So internal medicine is essentially adult focused medicine. Okay. So like when you do your internal medicine residency, you rotate through, you do general medicine, like outpatient clinic, but you also have gastroenterology and cardiology and nephrology and infectious disease, all the different
subspecialties of internal medicine.
So you learn all of that stuff. And then you can either go on to do primary care or hospital medicine and stick with what's considered internal medicine, or you can do a subspecialty, which would be like GI, cardiology, nephrology, ID, et cetera, all those other specialties.
Okay. So it is a specialty, meaning it is a like area of specific care that a patient would have to like ask for, but it's not a specialty in that it's not its own classification in terms of medical school.
In terms of anal health or internal medicine?
Oh, anal health. Sorry.
Yeah, yes. It's almost, I don't want to say a made up specialty, but no. it is kind of a niche.
Yeah. So you said like here at Howard Brown Health, it is kind of classified as its own thing, despite it being kind of made up of different, you know, gastroenterologists and dermatologists and all the things that feed into anal health. So, what kind of population, you said, you know, LGBTQ plus people stand to benefit or at least need anal health care the most. Why is that the case, or what kind of conditions, align with that identity that we're on the lookout for?
Sure. So, I mean, the primary focus is screening for anal cancer, and trying to prevent anal cancer, as well, you know, particularly people who have anal sex, particularly men who have sex with men, or anybody else who has anal sex. You know, there's other issues that come up in terms of people have different symptoms and, you know, need to feel comfortable discussing these things, and sometimes need to have an anoscopy or something where we're not necessarily looking for cancer, but we're trying to look for other causes of pain or bleeding or other discomfort. And essentially, when you go outside of a place like Howard Brown, a lot of times patients face different obstacles. They may face discrimination. They may not be comfortable speaking with physicians or whoever they're seeing. So I think it's nice to have that option. And if I feel like I need to refer to a different specialist, I will, but at least it's a nice initial step for those patients.
Yeah. So, I mean, the kind of an obvious point, but I wanted to lay it out there that like butt stuff, regardless of your, you know, sexual orientation, puts a lot of strain on that area of the body. So, you know, being aware of what's good and what's bad and what's normal and what's not is important, and it feeds into, you know, cancer screening and making sure you're healthy in that way. So I just wanted to like lay that out there in case people were like, wait, anal medicine, what does that have to do with gay people?
Yeah. It's like, not specific just to gay people.
No, it's by no means, but
we just have a little bit more focus on that region of the body than some people.
Right. And it makes sense. So when you say, you know, you practice in anal health, what are some misconceptions or like, inaccuracies that people might have related to that area of medicine?
I don't know of necessarily
if there are any.
I think the biggest problem when it comes to patients is I think there's just a lot of hesitation to discuss these things. There's embarrassment, you know, people just don't feel comfortable talking about that part of the body, and that's a lot of just how our culture is. I think within the medical community, people are just ignorant. I mean, it's amazing how people who have been practicing medicine both for a long time, and even, you know, when I was training residents and medical students at Rush, how they hadn't even heard of anal cancer screening. They hadn't heard of high resolution anoscopy. And if they did, they knew very little, because it's still not being taught as well as it should be. And part of that is because it's a relatively new field, and especially now there's a lot more demand for screening, but I think a lot of it as well is just because, unfortunately, medicine that affects subsets of the population, particularly LGBTQ plus health, have been kind of put to the side over the years.
Right. It's because it doesn't affect everybody, or, you know, affect everybody as broadly. It's kind of maligned to a very niche specific focus and not necessarily something that everybody covers in med school. So.
Right. And interestingly enough, I mean, the person who is most well known to have had anal cancer was Farrah Fawcett. And one of the big foundations is actually the Farrah Fawcett Foundation that provides a lot of funding for research and screening for anal cancer. So it's interesting that even with that, it's sort of, and you know, that we're talking something that been in the, at least in the, in the, in the public eye for decades, but yet we still don't really talk about it.
That's a great point, because there's that way. It was that way with HIV for a long time too, until more and more celebrities or people of note started feeling comfortable to be honest about their conditions and what they're going through, and you know, things progress that way. So representation, being honest and talking openly, is certainly huge to increased healthcare outcomes as it relates to stuff like this. When thinking about Howard Brown's anal health program in specific, what is different about how we do things compared to, you know, if I was to seek treatment at Rush or somewhere similar? Is there anything like technically different, or is it more on how we talk to patients, handle patients? How does that all shake out?
I mean, for Howard Brown, I think it's everything. I think, for example, we have actual Howard Brown anal health screening guidelines, which are constantly evolving as the field evolves, but we actually have specific guidelines. Our providers are well aware that we have this program. They know to refer, they know to screen. And, you know, whereas if you go to a lot of these other places, people aren't even screened. And there certainly isn't necessarily any anal health specialist. Most of the time people referred to colorectal surgeons who, yes, they do anal health, that area, but they also do a lot of other things. They're focused on a lot of other things, you know, as far as not just the anus, basically. Right. They're focused on anything in that.
Right, all in the GI tract.
So it's a different, and they're much more surgically focused.
Yeah.
They like to operate, their surgeons. So, they're not necessarily looking to talk to people who are having anal pain or difficulty with sex or things like that.
Right.
And a lot of them really don't have much training in that area. Some do, some are excellent, but they don't all get that training.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see how, if you were a patient going in for just like a little lump or something you wanted checked out, and they're like, well, I don't know much about that, but here's a surgeon. And it's like, oh, that's a big escalation that I don't think I needed right away. And then also poses issues for insurance and all of that fun stuff. So it's cool to know that we have this program in place to kind of combat that and to, you know, solve stuff in other ways before just like, here's a surgeon.
Sure.
Not that surgeons are bad. That is obviously the,
and they don't necessarily try to take everybody to surgery, but it is that whole thing of, you know, they're not necessarily looking to have long conversations with people about, you know, what's going on with their butt. They just want to see, okay, is there something I need to operate on, or is it not? Okay.
Right. Yeah. That is the vibe that I've gotten from not only media, but like just anecdotally from the healthcare field, is like surgeons are usually pretty like in the zone, gotta operate generally. And their handwriting is always terrible, but that's an aside. So with you specifically, I know patients are probably reluctant to bring this up or talk about it. Or, I mean, do you only see patients who have been referred to you by, like a general care provider within Howard Brown Health? So they're like, they've already brought it up to somebody, or do you have to like kind of coax this information out of people yourself? Where does a patient come to you in the process?
Sure. The vast majority of referrals within Howard Brown, there's a few referrals outside of Howard Brown as well. We have had patients who have reached out because they've looked at the Howard Brown website, seen that we have these services, and they either want screening or they're having some kind of symptom. Generally, if it's for screening, anal cancer screening, they're curious, it's always helpful if they talk to their primary first, because sometimes they don't necessarily need to see me. Mm-hmm. But that being said, you know, I'm not going to turn anybody away if somebody has questions. And I've had patients that just come in, we just talk and we say, you know what, you don't need this today. You know, come see me in 5 years.
Keep an eye on it.
I've had that happen. So.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I could imagine if you were maybe, in at the primary level, that you'd probably have to have a lot of really good, like not bedside manner, but like patient skills in order to get the information you need from patients to bring it up in the first place. If there's something that's bothering them to, I don't know, I could just imagine being a patient and like, I have this thing, but you know, like dancing around it in weird terms and like, you know, just getting the information out of a patient, I feel like could be a challenge in this situation.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I've had that where a lot of times they give very minimal information to their primary, and I just get a referral, you know, patient's having some anal pain, or patient felt a lump, and I'm like, okay, you know, okay, that's about all the information I have, and that's about all that's documented in the chart. So, you know, a lot of times that's all we get. So,
yeah. And I feel like there could also be another layer to that when it comes to like physically examining somebody, because queer people might have, you know, trauma related to other people touching them in that area, or to just being that vulnerable in general, in a healthcare setting. So, what kind of training exists in med school for dealing with a sensitive patient population like this one? Does there exist
any? I mean, you know, now I think more med schools are starting to adopt more training in terms of dealing with different patient populations, more sensitivity training, cultural training, things like that. When I was in med school, I mean, my extent of anal health was, we had, you know, our day, we're going to do prostate exams today. And they had standardized patients, and literally, you know, bless this guy's heart, but he just sat there and we had a patient bend over, and just one after the other was like a line. Okay.
There's the prostate.
Put your finger in. Yeah. Feel the prostate. Okay. Next. I mean, that was it. Yeah. That's about all we got. And after that, it was, you know, you'd see patients and you do these exams. And the reality is, some people never do these exams again after med school. Mm. They just say, you know what, I don't want to do it. And they just don't do it. And the focus was always just, okay, feel the prostate. That's it. And there's a lot more to the butt than a prostate.
Right.
In fact, prostate's not technically even in the anus. You can just feel it from the anus. So it's
next door.
So it's next door. It's adjacent, as everybody knows. So in any case, you know, there's a lot more that should be taught than that. And maybe they teach more of that now. It's been a while since I've been in med school, but from my experience dealing with med students and residents, they didn't teach much more.
Gotcha. So how do we get med schools to take it seriously? Is that something that, as, you know, an established provider who's doing this kind of work specifically, does that take, you know, research and published papers? Does it take, you know, lobbying for new kinds of grants, or how do you get that kind of focus to be larger as it relates to med school?
Yeah, I think we're getting there. So a big part of medicine, we use this term evidence-based medicine. Mm-hmm. You always hear doctors throwing this around, which, you know, you want good data before you do things, and showing that you're not harming people, that you're doing the right thing, and you want the published studies. Recently, a couple of years ago, there's a big study called the Anchor Study, which was a landmark study looking at anal cancer screening and treatment. And that was published in New England Journal. There's brand new screening guidelines that have been established by IANS, which is the International Anal Neoplasia Society. Basically, it's a group that is made up of all of us that do this anal health in some way or another. And it's a global organization. And there's new guidelines that are actually supposed to be published any day now. So I think we're starting to get more attention. Like anything else, it's slow. It's going to take a while. Things don't change overnight in medicine. But this is huge in terms of getting the word out there. The other limiting factor is there's just not enough people who do this. And there's been a recognized need that now we're going to have to train all these people. And now Ian's that organization I was talking about strategies of how we're going to do this and how we're going to certify people to make sure people actually know what they're doing. And so, yeah, there's a lot more to come in terms of all of this. So it's rapidly evolving.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think about it also in terms of like, people are always saying that we need more doctors, we need more nurses and stuff. And maybe it's more of a conversation of what parts of medicine we focus on. Cause what I assume a lot of people think of when you say you're going to become a doctor is like a brain surgeon.
Or right.
Like
all those no one says I want to look at butts all day.
Right.
And that's the thing. And even now, I mean, you tell people, they're like, oh, I'm glad you do that, cause I don't want to look at an ass all day. Right. I mean, it's just the reality of it. But I thought that too, even myself. I was like, yeah, that's great. I'm glad someone does that. But once I actually started doing it, it was actually really interesting, and I enjoy it a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a challenge in a totally different way than doing primary care was.
Yeah.
It's a totally different pace. There's a lot of things that I think are attractive about doing this, but you know, you have to get over that hump. And I think you have to be a certain kind of person, because like you were talking about earlier, you're dealing with patients in a vulnerable position. Sometimes people come from all different backgrounds. Some people have had trauma in the past. Other patients are going to joke around with you and tell dirty jokes the whole time. So, you know, you have every extreme and you've got to make everybody comfortable.
Yeah.
And that takes a little bit of patience. And I think that, you know, it's not for everyone.
Yeah. And I imagine, not that if you're a doctor, there's not job security, but I would imagine when you're in an area like this, that so few people do it and do it well, that you know, your utilization and everything is higher, because you are one of the only people in the city doing this well. So it's like,
I'd like to think so, but you know, you never know. Yeah. I mean, you know, medicine is very fickle and every organization has their priorities. So I hope that Howard Brown continues to see the need for my
importance,
and there's always things that could change too, because now that I focus, you know, when I had primary care, primary care is rough. I mean, it's probably the hardest specialty in terms of just people getting burned out and having to, or at least one of them. And you know, it's a lot of work you definitely have to have appreciation for the people who do that. There's always job security though. There's a shortage. There's always going to be a shortage of primary care because not as many people are going into it because of that. This is something where, it could take, maybe there's another study that comes out that shows, okay, well now we don't need to do as many of these exams on people. We have some biomarker and only this number of people needs it. So, you know, it could always change, but for now it's growing. It's not shrinking. So I think at least for the next foreseeable future, for the next decade, more and more people are going to need to do this unless something changes dramatically. Yeah.
We like to see growth as it relates to like numbers of doctors in a field. We don't like to see growth as it relates to actual growth.
Exactly. And you know, there's certain things that may reduce the number of people needing this, but you know, right now we have a pretty big population who needs to be screened.
Yeah. So this is all very fascinating systemically. And I want to get into now the kind of nuts and bolts or nitty gritty of anal health in general, because I run Hard Run's TikTok. And as a result, I get a lot of like queer health related TikToks on my For You page.
Of course.
and one of them was like, I think they were like a colorectal surgeon or specialist or something. And they were like, here's things I would never do. And there was points about like using flushable wipes versus a bidet, or like, so in your experience, what are best practices or worst practices when it comes to anal health that people might not realize?
Sure. Don't use wet wipes.
Really?
Yes. People think when they get itchy back there, they have irritation, they start using those wet wipes. I mean, if you use it once or twice, because you need it, fine. But those tend to cause irritation. Even the ones say, oh, for sensitive skin, don't use that. Mm-hmm. It'll start causing cracking back there and irritation, all these things. And a lot of times people come in saying that they're having irritation. You find out they've been using those for a long time.
Yeah.
So that's a big one.
There's no kind of those that is good in your experience?
No.
Deep wipes, nothing?
There's something, I mean, the one thing I tell people to use when they have irritation, this isn't a plug, there's something called Balneol, which is actually used for babies, mostly. You can find it on Amazon.
What's it called?
Balneol, B-A-L-N-E-O-L, and it comes as wipes or something too. But if you have a lot of irritation back there, again, it's for like baby irritation, but it works. So if you're really itchy like back
akin
there,
akin to a diaper rash.
Yeah. So if you're itchy back there, try that. If you're still having itches, if it's staying here, make sure you have someone look at it to make sure there's nothing else going on. Use that if you have to use some kind of wipe or something back there. Another thing is, I think sometimes it's great people have anal sex, have all the anal sex you want, but be thoughtful. So if, you know, you got to work your way up, you know, sometimes people will just go from, you know, they haven't done anything for a while. They go from nothing to, you know,
something
pretty substantial back there. And then they get fissures and those kind of things. And then, you know, then they're out of commission for a while and then they go back and then they go right back to that. So make sure you're working your way up. That's something that I see a lot of people with pain, and we find they have fissures, and it's because they overdid it without
little ambitious
without working their way up. So gradual increase what you can take back there.
Gotcha. Is the squatty potty really actually beneficial where you have your like legs up, or is that just kind of,
I think it helps some people. You know, that's, I don't usually get into that conversation as much with people, but yeah, it does help. I don't know that it's quite the sensation that everybody made it.
That's what
you know, I don't know that everybody needs one. But for people who, I think it's more important if you're straining and that kind of thing, is to increase fiber in your diet, hydrate, all of that kind of stuff is going to make more difference than using a squatty potty, but it certainly can't hurt.
Yeah. And we like bidets. Bidets are good.
I like bidets. I like bidets. Okay. The rest of the world has evolved. America hasn't.
I installed one. I got it for my boyfriend for Christmas, which is like the least romantic Christmas gift, but we only said we were going to get things for each other that we both could use. So I was like, well, this qualifies. Yeah, it's certainly a different way of doing things. Is there?
That's absolutely hilarious, because my husband, when we went to Japan, and it was like the best thing ever, and he kept talking to me, So for his birthday, I got him one of the automatic bidets where the
seat the raises, lid and everything.
And he walks in the bathroom and it raised up and it said happy birthday.
Oh my gosh.
I just thought it was the best thing. So I think it's hilarious
that you did amazing. That. Yeah,
you know, that's when you know your relationship has hit a certain level when you're giving each other things for your butt. I'm a big fan of bidets. I think people tend to irritate themselves by wiping too hard. Another thing though is, as great as bidets are, another thing people do is spend too much time on the toilet. We all sit on the toilet, we look at our phones, we do all that stuff, and that makes hemorrhoids worse and things like that. So do what you gotta do and get off the toilet. Enjoy your bidet as long as you know, for a reasonable amount of time, but then move on.
Right. We're not just sitting there washing for long periods
Once
of time.
Once you get used to it, you don't feel like you need to do that.
Right. Anymore. Okay. Good to know. Good to know. as it relates to douching, are there mistakes that people make that either aggravate these conditions that you're seeing or just aren't helpful?
I think once again, it's about being gentle. You got to be careful, especially if you have something with a firm tip. You know, you don't want, you can cause scratches and things like that. And just overdoing the pressure, you just got to be
gentle.
Okay. It's fine to do, but only do it when you need to do it. Like, some people will do it just all the time. If you're going to be sexually active, you know, you're probably going to be fine. But if you know nothing's going to happen that day, don't do it. You know, give yourself breaks.
I mean, I as a cis gay man who's on the internet, know that there's probably people out there that are like, on the off chance I pull up Grindr and I'm in Target, let me quick just douche before my grocery run.
It doesn't take that long. You know, you can always say, pour your friend a drink and say, excuse me, I gotta use the bathroom.
Right.
Take your time.
Being constantly douched isn't how our body is supposed to be.
It's not the greatest.
Good to know. And only ever with water, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So those are some anal health basics, baselines, in case you yourself are listening and want to learn more. We got that out of the way for you. And I want to focus on now how anal health how that relates specifically to cancer.
Yes.
So we kind of touched on anal cancer in the beginning, but this, this episode will air on World Cancer Day. So walk me through the biology of anal cancer itself. Are there other conditions like HPV that factor into it? How does that all lay that all out?
So anal cancer, fortunately, as cancers go, is a relatively rare cancer. That being said, there are certain risk factors that make you a lot more likely than the average person to get anal cancer. And one of those is living with HIV. That's one of the biggest risk factors. Even if you've always had good control, it just is. The other thing is having a high-risk strain of the HPV virus, and I can tell you about that a little more in a minute, but all anal cancer is related to the HPV virus. So it's different than colon cancer, which is genetic or other factors. Other risk factors, tobacco, like every cancer, a history of anal warts or genital warts is a risk factor, because that's consistent with a past HPV infection. Having a low T cell count is another risk factor for those living with HIV. So those are the main risk factors. And again, it's all related to HPV, and everybody's got HPV. Just about everybody. If you've had sex with more than one person, your skin's rubbed together, you probably have HPV. It's that common. There's over 100 types of HPV, but as far as the ones that tend to cause anal cancer, it's a much smaller number. Generally, we'll divide into like low risk and high risk HPV. The low risk ones more commonly cause anal warts or don't cause anything. The high risk strains are the ones that are more commonly associated with anal cancer. There's certain strains that are known to be particularly, there's one called type 16 that's the most commonly associated, but there's quite a few other strains. So we do see anal cancer and precancerous lesions in people who don't just have type 16, who have these other high risk types of anal HPV.
Gotcha. Okay. So the people that are living with HIV as an increased risk factor is due to their weakened immune system, correct?
I mean, that's the thought.
Okay.
That would be the most likely explanation, but I don't think it's completely understood. Because even people with undetectable viral loads who have never had a low T cell count still are at higher risk.
Interesting. Okay. So it's not even fully known.
It's not fully known. I mean, it's likely something to do with immunosuppression, but
numbers wise, it's a proven connection.
It's a proven connection.
Okay. And what about like, what if you're somebody that's living with HIV, but you're not somebody who regularly has receptive anal sex? Like, is that still a concern, even if you're not, you know,
it's
putting that area under stress?
Sure. It's definitely still a risk factor. It's definitely higher if you've had anal sex at some point in your life. If you've never had anal sex, your risk is lower, but there's still increased risk with HIV.
Gotcha. Okay. So take your prep, everybody. So in terms of screening, and this is true for kind of a lot of cancers, it feels like, as it relates to like certain things you can self-screen for and certain things you can't. When it comes to screening for anal cancer, if you're somebody within those at-risk groups or just somebody who, you know, has receptive anal sex, what kind of screening can you do for yourself? What kind of things can you watch out for, and how regularly should you be doing that? And when do you escalate it to a doctor?
Sure. As far as things you can watch out for yourself, is any symptoms back there. If you're having unusual pain, if you're having bleeding that's unusual, if something just doesn't feel right, if you feel something yourself, like any kind of lump back there, or, you know, you just happen to, you or a partner feel something, it's always good to get that checked out. Unfortunately, unlike STI testing and some of these other things, self-swabs haven't been shown to be very effective because...
Is that a thing? Self-swabs, like... then send in? Or?
Right. Well, for example, people self-swab for gonorrhea, chlamydia. Okay. You know, they'll just hand you a swab and say, hey, go to the bathroom.
Or that kind of self-swab. Yeah. Gotcha.
Whereas for the anal pap test, which we do, you have to get cells. And generally, people just don't do it well enough. So unfortunately, that's so far something that's recommended to do with your primary care.
Gotcha.
Or
when you say get cells, is that like... you like scraping-ish a little bit more? Yeah,
it's not painful at all. The whole thing takes about 20 seconds. Okay. So basically, if you've ever done your gonorrhea chlamydia test, it's a little swab. It's made out of polyester. It looks like a Q-tip. Mm-hmm. It's nothing fancy. But basically, you go in about an inch and a half and then or 2 inches and then just kind of swab the side of the wall. You got to put a little pressure on the sides of the wall. So it's not a scratchy like a
right.
like a broom. It's literally just looks like a Q-tip, but it's a little bit scratchier than
just got to be a little bit more.
And like, you know, when you're testing for chlamydia, you just shove it up there, pull it out. It's good enough. Yeah. Whereas this, you have to make sure you're
getting contact all around with the walls, wall
and making contact. And it's very hard to do yourself.
Yeah.
But it's not like a cervical pap smear that people assigned female have to get because, you know, there you're having to physically put in a speculum and visualize. It doesn't require any of that. So when people hear a pap smear, they think, including physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, whoever's doing this, if they've never seen it before, they think it's a much more complicated procedure than it is. They envision it being this whole big deal. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's a swab for rub it around for 20 seconds and you're done.
I liken it to like when at home COVID tests first came out, where it was like they really stressed about what works swabbing wise and what doesn't, and what will actually get the sample that you need. So I imagine it's probably similar, where it's like you can do a little bit yourself, but it's probably better to go to a doctor and have them do it. Because I know with COVID, I was like, I don't want to. It felt like it was in your brain, and I was like, I'm not going to do that to myself, but I'll sit for a doctor and let them do it.
Yeah, I mean, COVID test is easier to do yourself than this.
True. Yeah, there's a lot less like bending.
Yeah, it's not the easiest place
to reach and
do this adequately. Unfortunately,
that's fair.
And because of that, that's unfortunately why people don't get screened as much, because you know you're going to your primary and they have 20 other things to do, and this doesn't always come up, and then it's you have to have that conversation and it can be awkward and all of that. So you know, one of my goals at Howard Brown is to get everybody screened who has risk factors, and again, these new screening guidelines are going to help sort of focus on the people who are highest risk and who need to be screened.
Yeah, I feel like with anal health, it's also one of those areas of a person's health that is probably easier to ignore to a certain extent, if the symptoms are only present, you know, during sex or something like that.
Exactly.
Where it's like, you know, if you have a problem with your vision, you use that 24/7, at least while you're awake. And so anal health, it's like, oh, yeah, it's not great, but I just won't have sex for a while. I hope it goes away. That kind
right.
of thing.
Right. And the reality with cancer screening is most people don't have any symptoms. Mm. So, you know, if you're having symptoms, it may not, you know, it could be a million other things, but the vast majority of people who I find something in have no symptoms, whether it's cancer or pre-cancer.
Gotcha.
So, you know, and we find a lot of pre-cancerous areas. Unfortunately, most of those don't turn into cancer, but the recommendation is still to treat them because we don't know which ones will and which ones won't.
Yeah. The latest blog we did was on telemedicine. And so that's why I think about this is what are there, or could you imagine any, parts of what you do that are compatible with telemedicine? I will say gay men at least, are pretty decent at photographing themselves
they are.
So, you know, I guess a broader way to ask this question is, what does the future of anal health look like as it relates to technology or better screening or at home care, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, maybe if there was something on the outside they wanted you to take a look at, you know, they could maneuver themselves or snap a pic. But unfortunately, you can't really do a high resolution anoscopy over a computer, and you can't really do it to yourself. But, you know, I think maybe for follow-up or just getting a history from people explaining things, you can do that over telemedicine. This isn't a field at this point that really
they're prioritizing when it comes to telemedicine. That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. I mean, it's not a field that they're necessarily prioritizing in general. So
exactly.
For telemedicine, it's a bit of a stretch. You mentioned high resolution endoscopy, and I realized we didn't cover precisely what that is.
Yeah,
can you walk us through what a high resolution endoscopy is?
Right. So that's basically looking in the anus with a microscope and looking for anything abnormal. So generally the people that will do that on have that initial PAP high risk HPV test that I was telling you about, that little scratchy Q-tip. If that shows any abnormal results, that's when I'll see somebody for high resolution endoscopy, which is sort of the bread and butter procedure that I do. And what that involves is essentially you're putting in a scope with some numbing gel. You use vinegar, which helps show areas that are damaged by HPV, and brush on a little iodine solution. And then if you see anything that looks abnormal, you take little biopsies, which is most of the time painless, and send it off to the lab and see. And then if anything comes back as precancerous, we bring them back in and do the same procedure, except numb the area up, apply heat, and take it off. That's the most common way we treat them.
Gotcha. So it's like the ultimate photo shoot for your anus.
Ultimate butt photo shoot.
I love that. You know,
it's pretty funny. Like, we've had patients who are like, can I, because we have it on a screen. They're like, can I video this? I'm going to put this on my Grindr profile. Like, you know,
I mean, ultimate bill of, I guess, clean
floats,
health.
Whatever floats your boat.
Right. Yeah. If all looks good, I mean, there's no better proof that everything's good.
Yeah. Perfect asshole. Here you go.
Right. That's funny. In summary, so I'm making sure that we get these points. Risk factors for anal cancer is if you're somebody that's living with HIV, you have a history of anal warts, lesions, fissures, things like that. Or I guess even if you regularly have receptive anal sex,
if you've bottomed even once in your life, it's a risk factor. So, the only difference is for people living with HIV, the screening is generally done younger. With these new guidelines, looking like 35 and up should be screened for people living with HIV. People who have a history of anal sex or other risk factors, most people can get screened around age 45. That being said, these are just guidelines. So, you know, if there's somebody's having symptoms or has warts or there's other things going on, we mm-hmm. might screen earlier. But that's the new guidelines in terms of trying to identify the most high-risk patients. And the reason that's been set that way is we're finding that people living with HIV not only have higher incidence of anal cancer, but they're getting it at younger ages. Mm. People not living with HIV tend to develop anal cancer, you know, more and closer to 50, 60 versus 40s, 50s.
Okay. So, I mean, if you've ever had receptive anal sex, it should be on your radar for sure.
It should
sure.
be on your radar. Talk to your primary about gotcha. It. You know, if you're 25, don't worry about it. Get your HPV vaccine if you haven't had it, and that helps lower your risk. But, you know, once you're getting into your 40s, even if you're not living with HIV, it's something that you should have on your radar.
Yeah. This is kind of a tangent, but I remember I'm from Southwest Michigan, which is a pretty small town area, pretty religious.
Yeah.
And I remember the HPV vaccine. I remember like seeing commercials for, I think it was Gardasil.
Yep.
And there being a lot of discourse, I think even specifically my family, I think for my sister, I don't know so much for me, about like whether or not that was, you know, okay to give a teenager or, you know, a young adult, because it might, you know, seem like a green flag to like have sex or something. Is that narrative still around, or who are we giving?
It's always still around. Okay. And I'm surprised even, you know, this wasn't around, you know, when I was a kid, when a lot of us were kids, you know, when I was 12, this vaccine didn't exist. Mm-hmm. But you know, now they are giving it to people. Ideally you give it to kids before they become sexually active. That's mm-hmm. the whole point. And then when it first came out, they were only giving it to girls because they were looking at just cervical cancer. And then the thought was, okay, now we're going to give it to boys, not to prevent anal cancer. And that's still not the thought. The thought is, okay, we're going to prevent the boys from giving it to the girls so they don't get cervical cancer. So, you know, it is, you know, now people are starting to look at anal cancer, but the narrative, that's still not the narrative.
Yeah.
Even though it should be part of the narrative.
Part of the discussion.
Part of the discussion. There's also penile cancer, which is less common. It can help lower the chance of that as well. But, you know, the recommendations kept changing too. So it was only girls, then it was boys, but then it was only up to age 26. A few years ago, they upped it to now age 45. That's still the cutoff. If you go beyond 45, some people, there's still wishy-washy data as to how beneficial it may be after 45. And there's also,
and the age cutoff is because at that point they would assume that you'd already been exposed to HPV on some point.
I think that whether it just cost benefit, whether it's doing any good more than anything else, because the reality is people are sexually active past 45 and not necessarily having the same partner for the rest of their life. The thing about HPV is there's so many different strains. So the vaccine has 2 low risk and 7 high risk strains, and it doesn't have all of them. But you know, even if you've been exposed to some strains, you probably haven't been exposed to all 9 that are in the vaccine. So theoretically going forward,
you
could be
reduction.
Re-exposed. Sometimes your body will fight off HPV. It won't be detectable anymore, but then you can get re-exposed. So I recommend the vaccine for everybody 45 and under. And then, you know, going past that, we may have more data eventually. Right now, the data doesn't support it enough. So most time insurance won't cover it past age 45.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's the other thing that I always forget factors into this kind of specialty medicine, which is like healthcare coverage. And your experience, is anal health something that healthcare is usually okay with covering, or how does Howard Brown navigate that? Because I know that can be a doozy.
I think Howard Brown is unique in that, you know, we don't turn people away. So we'll see anybody, covered or not, we'll see people. But the reimbursement is pretty widely variable. Where you really, unfortunately, particularly Medicaid, which has terrible reimbursement for everything, does not reimburse very well, not nearly as well as they should. And, you know, that's a big part of the population, and honestly, a lot of the higher risk population. So, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, with more data and everything, that they will start covering things better. You know, I'm fortunate to work at Howard Brown where I used to always have to worry about that. I mean, it's still important. Howard Brown is definitely looking at the bottom line, as we all know, but it's one of those things that, you know, they're not going to say, oh, you can't see this person because their insurance doesn't cover.
Right.
This.
You're not in a situation then where you have to like, I'm not going to treat you. Or I can't treat you.
Yeah. I see a lot of people who don't have any insurance. So That's kind of the nice thing about working at Howard Brown.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is unfortunate that one insurance may pay thousands of dollars for a treatment, whereas another insurance may give you $100. I mean, which basically cover the cost of the supplies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of variation.
Gotcha. So we've been at it for almost 50 minutes now, so we'll wrap things up. But in terms of anal health, I guess the first of the last questions I'll ask is, what are your, what's your hope for the future regarding anal health? Is it better education and awareness, different tools, different procedures? What do you hope for going forward as somebody that works in this area?
Yeah, my biggest hope is that it falls on everybody's radar and everybody who needs to get screened gets screened. Hopefully that, and I think if that's the case, it'll encourage more people to do this. They're talking about now having official certification for this to make sure that everybody's somewhat on a level playing field in terms of knowing what they're doing and patients are getting the right care, because there's a lot of people that do these procedures who really aren't trained and don't necessarily give patients the same screening. So everybody should get, wherever you go, that's what I would hope, that this is available everywhere. So that we're not losing people. So I think that's the biggest thing is awareness, more people who are doing this and making sure that everybody who needs to get screened gets screened.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. And what would you say if somebody, you know, is in a place like small town Southwest Michigan and doesn't maybe have access to a healthcare center that provides this kind of culturally competent care like we do here at Howard Brown Health, what suggestions do you make to a person like that about in terms of how to advocate for themselves or ask a provider that might not be knowledgeable?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, you just have to show them, particularly if you're living with HIV, show them there's the big study, the Anchor study, show them the new guidelines that are going to be published. They'll be searchable online. Again, it's going to be, I don't know, anytime you can look, International Anal Neoplasia Society. They can look up that website, which has all kind of information, links to, there's plenty of information online. If you look at, there's also misinformation, of course, but looking at reliable sources and show that and say, hey, I have risk factor. I need an anal pap and a high risk HPV test. It's not that hard to do. Anybody can look up how to do it. It's just not that difficult. It's hard to do on yourself.
Sure, there's a YouTube tutorial for that.
It's on YouTube. It's hard to do on yourself, but it's not hard for any kind of primary care physician, nurse practitioner, PA, whoever you see. They should be able to do that for you. And then if it's normal, great. You can just repeat it every year or two. If it comes back positive, that's when you're going to probably have to go find a center that does it. But more and more places are doing it. So I think, you know, that's the best way you can advocate for yourself is just again, it's evidence-based. Mm-hmm. That should convince anybody. We have the evidence.
Yeah. I mean, education and evidence is always the baseline of fighting conditions that have a lot of miseducation or prejudice. Stigma surrounding them, whether it's HIV or anal cancer or whatever it is. So that's a great recommendation. And I'll put links to those studies in the episode description below. If you're listening and you want to access those and have those on hand, I'll link them below. But any final words for people listening as it relates to anal health, anal cancer, cancer screenings in general, anything that we missed that you feel needs to get out there?
I mean, I think we covered most things, but I would just tell everybody, you know, don't be shy. Everybody's got a butt, you know? We all have issues. Everybody has issues with their butt. Don't hesitate to talk about it.
I think that's a children's book. I think it's called We All Poop.
Yeah, Everybody Poops.
Everyone poops.
Yep. Yeah. It's a great book.
I'll put the link to that in the bio below as well. But that is a great closing sentiment here. Thank you so much for your time, for doing this important work.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for focusing on an area of medicine that, like we said, not so many people are super interested in. But in the meantime, for everyone listening on this World Cancer Day, remember, screen yourself, know your body, advocate for yourself and your healthcare when you need to, and stay safe and healthy. Thanks for listening. And that has been our episode on The Whole Truth, all about butts. If you're interested in any of the anal health resources that we mentioned in this episode, I'll put links in the description below. Otherwise, you can go to www.howardbrown.org to learn more. Thanks so much for listening.